Okay, we got it. Okay. Let me get started here. Dealing with Revelation and Matan Torah. Students, today are going to be opening discussions, opening things. Hold off until I finish this whole download, so to speak, before I take questions. To even have some sense of what this class is going to be about, then I will go over the syllabus. Okay. So unequivocally, there are principles of Jewish thought in the Bible and the Talmud. The Bible and the Talmud presuppose God, Har Sinai, Nisim, Hashgacha. It's left to the medievals to make universals. As philosophers, they thought in terms of universals. They will no longer have it as a specific event, like it's Yat Mitzrayim. But they'll universalize it as philosophy. What is the miracle? What is prophecy? How does one prove God? The early stage of this activity was started by the Gaonim, most famous of which is Sadigon. And the Ikarim of Judaism don't go back to Rambam, they actually go back to Sadia. There's a wonderful article of Ben Shammai where he publishes the Ikarim of Sadia. That in the Gaonic world, you formulated your own religion against the other religions, in this case Judaism versus Christianity, Islam, and heresy. And they were formulated as universals for all. Meaning the Ikarim of Sadia and then eventually Rambam are rather generic universals because they're what's true versus what's false in terms of comparing you to another religion. They tend not to appeal to specific Jewish texts like the Talmud. They become universals by which Sadia can then say the Buddhists, the Hindus, the Christians, and others are wrong. And Sadia wanted to situate himself in a certain middle between those, on one hand, who believed that God was inscrutable, everything is predetermined, the Bible or the Quran was pre-created, everything was magical. On the other side, you have those who thought everything was naturalistic. And he wanted to steer a course in between. And that's what Sadia did. So too with God. On one extreme, you had one side who said everything is God's will and everything's inshallah. The other side said everything's naturalistic. And he, on the other hand, wanted to formulate a universal of what is providence. The Rambam, obviously, is more famous to all of you in his early writing, the Perush Mishnayot, continued this Gaonic trend and gave you Ikarim, a universal Ikarim to think about. That's not what he actually did in the Moreh Nebuchim, where his goal was to come up with a philosophic understanding of religion, which is not the same as formulating Ikarim. To jump ahead to the end of the 14th, beginning of the 15th century, Crescas in his Or Hashem, and Albo and his Sefer Ikarim no longer are asking the question, what is universal religion? But they're asking the question, what do I have to believe as a Jew? And that's going to change the whole deck. Meaning where for the Gaonim or the Rambam, everything was, here's a list, here's what we stand for. Crescas and Albo's question is, what does it mean to be religious? So, for example, Crescas and Albo will say belief in God is not an ikar. It's a presupposition to being religious. If you weren't religious, if you didn't believe in God, you wouldn't be reading this book in the first place. So it's not an ikar. On the other hand, prophecy would be seen as an ikar, as something one has to accept and be told one has to accept. On the other side, belief in the Mashiach is downgraded only to a pina, is downgraded to something that's just a point but not seen as a basic tenet. because that's not the basis of one's religious life or not. So very different than the Maimonidean perspective. God is not an Ikar. Mashiach is downgraded to a Pina. Nebuah is the only real Ikar. And notice that if you make Mashiach not an Ikar, what you've really done is said Tanakh is not the basis for your Ikarim. You've instead created some other category of belief. Interestingly enough, Crescas and Alvo consider Birchat Kohanim a Pina, that Birchat Kohanim, the fact that it has magical properties in order to bring down Bracha, because that's the tradition. Or they believe in Shedim is a Pina, because you have to have a Muna Chachamim. So on the Sadia Rambam, it's some universal category, they're already dealing with what one has to believe. Let me rephrase that differently. Let's deal with some of the questions of the Maimonidean controversy and reformulate what really went on. When Rav Meir Abulafia, the author of the Yad Ramah, said that the Rambam did not believe in Tziyat HaMeitim, his argument was being kofer of Perek Chelek of Sanhedrin. Meaning, the Yad Ramah, as the Talmudist, expected anything you formulated, Machshava, had to go not just according to some general religious categories, the universals, but had to include Rabbinic Judaism. Or, when Nachmanides argues and says that there we have traditions of great sodotes that go beyond the natural order, Nachmanides is introducing a greater sense of the supernatural outside the rational as playing an element. A third element that comes up here, besides the belief in God, I mean, the acceptance of the Talmud, whether you're being accepting of Chazal, the second one is the role of the supernatural, is the role of allegory. And not all allegories are equal. For whatever reason, we've lost our discernment in being able to appreciate the difference. Because even if you say a text is an allegory, there's a big difference between being, let's say, being Genesis, between being Moshe Ibn Tzibbon, who said Genesis is talking about meteorology, being Moshe Narbonne, to say it's talking about conjunction of the intellect with the divine, The Isaac Arama, the Akedah, who says that the Genesis is an allegory for morals and ethics. The allegory of the Al-Sheikh and the Gra that says Genesis is about the journey of Yunushama. And then finally, the Rav Hirsch and Hertz allegory, in which everything's an allegory for serving God and doing mitzvot. To say that the Bible is teaching you meteorology is not the same as saying the Bible is teaching you mitzvot. That's the medieval background. When we come to the early modern period, rather than looking for universals or beliefs, everything now becomes reformulated. And here in early modern period, I'm including Maharal, Ramchal, Chassidut, and Mitnadut. There, things are reformulated as being either imminent within the community, and two, having a cause and effect. Imminent in the community is no longer you say Judaism is biblical religion, but you now make it your current community here and now has qualities of prophecy, providence, messianism, right here and now, or your leadership has it. I mean, there's a difference between saying a biblical prophet, meaning for medieval, there's a difference between a biblical prophet and you today. The early modern period asks, where is prophecy right now in the Beit Midrash? The second point is the cause and effect. Early modern period, Maral, Ramchal, Chassidut, Mitnadut, assume there's a that everything in Judaism actually affects both this world and the heavens. So doing an act of prophecy or doing a mitzvah not just affects the spherotic realm up above, but affects this world also. In general, the old-time modern Orthodox canon only included the medievals, didn't include the early moderns. The yeshiva canon always included the early moderns. And that's going to be one of the dividing lines, how seriously you have to take that material. I mean, if everyone says you have to take Sadia, Rambam, Albo seriously, how much do you have to take Maharal, Ramchal, Nefesh HaChayim seriously? Third period we come to is the modern period, in which now you have Jewish thought has to confront Western thoughts, and it has to confront the challenges of modernity. Once again, how much you are taking into account the challenges of modernity in your formulations and how much you don't becomes a factor. So let me now play out those three time periods with our topic, Revelation. For the medievals, they created a universal called Nevuah. And they clearly said, this is how you go about achieving Nevuah. And I'm going to give you a fancy English word for the medieval position, because they weren't naturalists or supernaturalists. They were what's called preternaturalists. A preternaturalist is someone who believes there's something beyond the natural realm, meaning prophecy. You don't generally have prophecy when you go to the grocery store or walking down the street, but there is a quality of humanity that's greater than ordinary life, and that's called preternatural, as opposed to supernatural, which means that God has to directly get involved and violate nature. Meaning, for most philosophers and capitalists in the Middle Ages, if you do the proper concentrations, meditations, perfection of the self, you will go beyond the intellect and you will then receive prophecy. The supernatural position is, God coming down, tapping Abraham on the shoulder and saying, hey, kill me a son. Just becomes that sort of a outside perspective. Preternatural means that they clearly were on a path of self-perfection, and there are higher states in which one can reach. The early modern period deals with Nevuah as part of the Beit Midrash, as Das Torah, as is it still on our Gedolim. And they deal with it in terms of a mechanism, a cause and effect mechanism, dealing with either a religious science or a Kabbalistic science. And that becomes the bigger element of how do we relate to that material. And finally, in the modern period, rather than Nevuah, and rather than where do you find Nevuah in the Beit Midrash, the modern period asks a brand new question, which is going to be the topic of the first, at least third of this course, Revelation. Revelation is the clear problem of, if we believe in modern reason, how can revelation be possible? It's no longer how do you make yourself into a prophet, like the medieval or early modern question. It's now the possibility and the value of still affirming Revelation. Let me do a little bit more background and then I'll take questions. In terms of dealing with these questions, there's currently no clear calculus of how to do it. Certainly not in America. Cook has a very famous essay that he wanted there to now be a chronim for Machshava, in which we would then know how to play off Sadia, Rambam, Yehuda Halevi, Mitnag Dut, Chassidut, that we would know how to argue back and forth between them, It never came to be. In general, his students just created a Machshavas Yisrael, in which here's the canon of classic books, go out and read them. But certainly to be able to argue between them never came to be. On the other hand, if we go back to modern orthodoxy, Walter Wurzberger has a very clear statement that you're free to believe in anything you want, so long as it can be formulated as a meta-halachic principle. So long as it can be formulated and not violate your halachic realm, and you're open to any formulation. What we're going to be doing is we're going to be actually using some of it to the terms that go on in the academy, which is more of an outgrowth of Christian seminaries, in order to help us deal with these topics. So let me give you some different terms here. Hold on for a few minutes while I give you some terms. Because Jews tend not to know how to talk about these things. First of all, apologetic theology, historic theology, systematic theology, sacramental theology. Apologetic theology is trying to answer a challenge of modernity. If you live in an age that denies God, how do you defend that God exists? If you live in an age that believes in biblical criticism, how do you defend against it? If you believe in an age that denies providence, how can you defend against it? Apologetic theology makes a lot of use of philosophy, sociology, history, psychology, because you have to appeal to something in order to convince someone. You have to get them from point A to point B. You have to take them from outside to inside. If they don't believe in God, then you're going to, here's 12 reasons to believe in God. You know, you're going to use philosophy, sociology, psychology, whatever you're going to use. Historic theology, category number 2, is formulating past opinions. Formulating what people held in the past, but it doesn't necessarily mean you accept it. And this is where Jews tend to trip up. The fact that you find in some Jewish history book somebody once believed something doesn't mean it's a particularly useful belief. The history is not the same as dealing with a theology question. Historic theology is how to formulate it, not just that you have a historically interesting character, but how to formulate what they actually held. But that doesn't mean that anybody who ever lived says something particularly meaningful. The third category, systematic theology, is that how do you then formulate what we actually hold? How do you formulate doctrine for today? And we're going to be coming back to that in a minute, about how do you formulate things for today. Fourth category, I'm just putting this out to get it off of the table, what Christians will call sacramental theology, Jews will tend to call Taimei HaMitzvot. That everything, all what we call the machshava around the mitzvah, what is everything you want to know about Pesach, it is not apologetic to any outside approach. It's not proving you anything. It's not historic. It's not systematic. It's giving you enough time to have mitzvot in order to teach about it. You know, that would be the classic course of what is the Christian or Jewish idea of marriage, and you give enough material to help the clergyman go forward, to have enough to keep them busy in life. But it's not answering any question, nor is it historically interesting. It's something very hands-on. Back to systematics. Since we're dealing with Revelation, systematics is about debating the pros and cons of different positions, dealing with their usefulness. Underline that word usefulness. It's not big in the Jewish vocabulary because we either think it's historic, it once existed, and that's all that one has to ask. The question here is usefulness. Now, usefulness is many criteria, and then that will even be the debate, but what does one use to choose a useful theology? To give you at least 11 to 12 different criteria of judging usefulness. One will be faithfulness to the Bible. Two, faithfulness to rabbinic texts. And that's a complex one because we don't accept every rabbinic text. There's no clear line about which psikdas and which tanchumas we accept. Three, how philosophically useful it is, or how philosophically logical or cogent it is. Fourth, which is a variant on three, what does one even want in philosophy? Does one want a proof? Does one want a probability? Or does one just want a polemical or debate argument? You know, what it is you're looking for. If you want an ironclad proof, it's different than just wanting a probability or just wanting something to argue with someone. Four, how well it deals with empirical reality. Five, how much it strengthens people's faith in that topic. Six, how much it can appeal to people. Seven, the ethical implications of it, and with that I can put political and social. Eight, how it answers the issues of the age. Nine, how it preserves tradition. Or ten, whatever I'm up to. 11, how it works with the medieval positions. And 12, how well it works with the early modern positions, if you're going to take them into account. And I'm going to keep asking that question of usefulness throughout the course. It's not just to historically catalog everything everybody said, but it's usefulness. Now I'll take some questions before I go on. Yes?
Your third of 12 points to how philosophically useful, logical, or cogent it is.
Yes.
Where would you fit in how it fits in philosophically? Or
I would put that out. I could add that 13.
Okay.
If you add lots of these. Any others? No question? Yes.
Between number 3, how philosophically useful or logical it is, what's the relationship between that and number 8, where we say we have an ethical, and then you add a political or social, but...
Because you could still have a thinness on it that works philosophically, but it's not particularly ethical or socially meaningful. Yes?
Did medievalists think in terms of ramifications?
Medievals or medievalists?
Yeah. They think about how their what their thoughts were, how they backed them practically, halakhically, or they didn't even think about
it. It depends who. And that becomes the question. If you're asking halakhic questions, and then already if halakha is important for you to formulate a theory of revelation, then already you're going to be writing out many of the Gaonim and many of the historic approaches, or many of the Maimonideans that were not concerned with that. That's exactly why I'm not giving you this list is for you to think about, but know that whatever you put in the list and whatever you're trying to answer will already determine who's going to be a useful person. The fact that I find some obscure 14th century person who said something against the Talmud, if you think that any theology has to in some way work with the halakha, then it's not a particularly useful text for you. Yes.
I imagine that the ranges of usefulness vary from each time period, right?
Yes.
So with the modern period, as you're saying, I was dealing with questions of modernity. It seems like it's only apologetics. So wouldn't that be one of the only definitions for usefulness under the modern period?
No, we're going to say that moderns were not just concerned with apologetics. They were concerned with a broad range of issues. So with that, let's get down to the syllabus. Some of you already have it through email. How many of you already have a copy through email? Good. Those of you who don't, please give it to those people who do not. Raise your hand if you don't have a copy. We are short. Yeah, how many are we short? One short, two shorts.
Okay.
Email me, whoever it is, short email me tonight. I'll attach a new one that'll be up on the web if it isn't already. Okay. This course will attempt to move beyond the modernist concern with the external elements of the events, the situating relevation within the theological context of 6-8 models, and then presenting a traditional views of prophecy. Then in the second part of the course, we'll confront the modernist questions generated by historic criticism and the debate that ensued. We'll discuss Louis Jacob's case, Mordechai Breuer, and others. And then four, we'll discuss the role of revelation in creating an interpretive tradition with a divine guarantee. Meaning, for those who can't figure out what those four parts are, one, we're going to start with the moderns. Two, we're going to go to the medievals. Three, we're then going to do the apologetic question of biblical criticism. And then four, we're going to go deal with the early moderns. Okay. There'll be a midterm, a take-home essay, and a final. Handouts will all, I hope to all be on the web. There will definitely be a midterm, which will be someplace that will include all the moderns and the first half of the medievals. Wherever we break, that's where it's going to go up to. The final will include, besides the biblical criticism question, it'll then deal with the early moderns. Your paper topics, I will want to be on something for the first half of the course, only because last time I had people saying, oh, I definitely want to do something from the last class or two, and then the paper never winds up showing up. If you do it from the first part, it'll show up in a timely manner. Okay. We're going to get down in a few minutes to do some texts from Gemara on Ma'amar Har Sinai. Okay, but Revelation. Revelation is an 18th century idea that grew out of a view in which autonomous reason was contrasted to supernatural revelation. So if you want to know, revelation did not exist as a problem until the 18th century. Only when the 18th century said revelation was impossible, then people had to come up with theologies of revelation. In the 19th century, revelation was less of an issue because everybody believed in a spirit that guided humanity. It came back in the 20th century as an almost insolvable issue before the secularism, modernity, and science. We are going to be using Avery Cardinal Dulles' book, Models of Revelation, in which he'll give five models from the 20th century. So the first part of the course will be applying those five models to Jewish thinkers. And now at the start of the 21st century, the rationalism of the 20th century has taken a step backwards. On the other hand, we have all sorts of new religious trends, and we're going to try to evaluate their viability. So the required text for the course is Avery Dulles' Models of Revelation. Many of you, since it is a required text in many courses, you can get used copies on Amazon for those of you who like it. What? $5. When I made the syllabus a few weeks ago, there were copies for $2, $3. So somebody already got there, whether here or elsewhere. But it is clear, it is out there. Order it, it'll come quickly. It is a basic textbook. As I told you, the primary text will be uploaded on the web, so after today I will not give you photocopies. So everything from the Hirsch on, meaning next class, has already, I think, been uploaded. Upload yutara.org. There will be a section for this course. Right now, I think it's just being put up in the back of Kabbalah or someplace on a back page somewhere because it needs the official, it needs someone there to go put it on a four page.
You just search for something on the website.
Yeah. if you want, we can create a teeny URL, and that also may be the best way to do it. So next class we deal with 19th century issues. Then we deal with the five models. It gives you already a week to get a hold of Dulles. Model number one, the doctrinal one. Model number two, the historic one. Model number three, experience. Model number four, dialectic. Model number five, new awareness. And then we're going to go into various six, seven, eight, the various other possible models that are out there, depending on your interests. Unit two, the medievals. Okay, I'm going to do read a little part of page four here, the top of it. The medievals did not have a category of revelation. They didn't have a tension between reason and revelation. Why? Three reasons. One, for them, human knowledge and divine knowledge were commingled, and various forms of intuitionism, metaconsciousness, prophecy, and contemplation were continuity of ordinary consciousness. We're not used to thinking in those terms, but they did. Two, they thought that eternal philosophy and psychology are truer than contingent history. And three, they knowledge was focused on a religious text, unlike modern autonomous reason. The required reading there is Harvey Chrysell. Oh, let me go back to Harvey Chrysell's prophecy. I haven't put page numbers in yet. That's on reference in the library. But if you look back on page two, I skipped over by accident. At the bottom of page two, required, Ripka Horowitz's essay, Revelation and Bible in 20th Century Jewish Philosophy. That'll give you a nice overview of how it's dealt with, not through Dulles. We then do Stadia, Rambam, Ramban, Zohar, Alba, Chaim Vital. You'll have a good time with all this. Then we deal with the biblical critical problem. I'll give you page numbers from Louis Jacobs. It kept coming out of different editions. I will give you page numbers from at least one or two, some guidelines. I remember there's no reason for not having pages here. There was some problem in whatever ancient edition I have, not corresponding to anybody else's edition. So I'll give some description there. Then how Gilman deals with it. We'll then talk about Mark Shapiro's historic approach and the limits of Orthodox theology. And then we can talk about the difference between systematic theology and historic. Then we'll deal with Heschel's Heavenly Torah, how he deals with it. This reading may be cut down, but since this is the first time this volume has ever been available in English, I have no idea how people will react to it. You know, but right now you have the gold mine of material that he has within there. I give you a lot of other things that relate to the topic. They'll come up in discussion, and we'll figure out what we want to do with them. Top of page six. Final topic is the role of tradition, where we do the Ron and the Maharal, and then into Chassidut, Midnagdut, Polish Chassidut, and I'll pick some contemporary, probably with Chaim Freelander. But you will have to read Gerald Brun's Hermeneutics, Ancients and Moderns, the chapter on Midrash, for you to understand that the idea of authorship is entirely a modern issue. Pre-moderns didn't think in those terms. Obviously, Sagi's Elu Ve'elu, when he formulates all these positions, and then once again, Heschel's gold mine of material. Questions? Okay. Well, let's get started here. Let's start. I don't know if I have enough. I think maybe one or two short again. What will be on the website is where you see all the primary picks, Hirsch, and then Shadal, Weinberg, Norman Lamb, Ivan Lichtenstein, then you see Haram, Berkowitz, Breuer, Miller, Bunim, then Buber, Cook. Heschel will not be on the website, then Rosolovation, Shia Leibowitz, then Rosenthal, Levy, Nas, Bohr. They'll all be up, all the primary texts will be up on the website. All of the handout stuff will be up there. And especially for those of you who are sitting here with laptops, you could be sitting here with an open PDF in front of you. This paper route is just so, you know, so anachronistic at this point. For nostalgia reason, I'll still give one answer out today. Or once again, once it's uploaded, you can all download it all immediately into a CD-ROM for yourself. I mean, there's we've reached the 21st century. You can figure those things out by now. Okay, can I get someone to read to bottom of 2:10, concerning each commandment? This is from Shai Agnon's present Sinai, where he collects all the statements dealing with Mamar Har Sinai. I have someone to read.
Yeah. Rabbi Yeshua?
Oh, yeah.
Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said, what is meant by the verse, his cheeks are like beds of spices? Each utterance of the Holy One, blessed be He, filled the world with fragrance. And since the first utterance had already filled it, what happened with the second? The Holy One, blessed be He, took the wind from His storehouses, and with it caused the fragrance of each utterance in turn to be wafted away, as is written. His lips are like lilies, they drip flowing myrrh. Read it not as lilies, but those who study. Sheshanim as opposed to Shoshanim. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi also said, with each utterance of the Holy One, blessed be He, Israel fainted away, as it is written, I was faint because of what He said. But if they fainted from His first utterance, how could they receive the second? He rained down dew, that which one day will resurrect the dead and revive them, as it is written, You release the bountiful rain, O God, when Your own land languished, You sustain it. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said further, With each utterance of the Holy One, blessed be He, Israel recoiled 12 miles, but the ministering angels led them back, as it is written, The angels of the hosts are in headlong flight. Read it not as ye dodun are in headlong flight, but as ye dedun, lead them.
Okay, this is a straight text from the Talmud that many of you know. What does this think Revelation is? What does this think Revelation is? What went on Har Sinai? Yes.
Supernatural.
What occurred there supernaturally?
God comes down, speaks to them.
Speech is not the major issue here. These utterance, I mean, these big, you know, big words come, whatever these utterances are, came down, and then what happens? What is it accompanied by?
Fragrance.
What else?
Fainting.
Same thing.
Running away.
What?
Being pushed away.
Pushed away. What else? Do resurrection of the dead. What else? 12 mil away, you're pushed back. Angels. Okay. Those of you who are trying to be loyal to the rabbinic text, what do you do by the fact that I'm not going to find any, this is an open Gemara, that I'm not going to find any 20th century thinker making very much out of this? Why? Why? Do you think that the Nehru Salvation just wanted to push away the Gemara? I mean, why do you think, yes?
It's one of Levinas' reading.
I know that, trust me.
It's 20th century thinker.
What? That's correct.
Major 20th century.
That's correct. Okay, so Levinas will bring this back. But why do most others not?
It doesn't tell you about the experience. It tells you
tells you about what happened.
Well, who says it's supposed to tell you about experience? What happened? So that's the whole point, is even if you're asking what went on, the rabbinic texts are more concerned with telling you what went on. They're not creating a medieval universal. And if you do, you're going to be a Kabbalist who's going to talk about the great power of the divine names and the divine words and how they perfume the world. But it's not going to be telling you about the whole experience. And moderns, on the other hand, this is not going to answer the question of reason. Let's try another one of these to say what your data is that you're coming into this with. Can I get someone to read? The Lord said to Moses in the right hand side. All right, left hand side. Okay.
The Lord said to Moses, "Thus shall you say, just as I dictate to you. Thus shall you say to the Israelites, the holy tongue. Wherever is scripture by the words, thus, so, co, or contrary, variations on answer spoke, means the holy tongue. You yourself saw that from the very heavens. There is a difference between what a person sees with his own eyes and what others relate to him. What others relate to him, he may act immediately, but here you yourself saw. Rabbi Nathan said, why does it say you yourself saw? Because it is written, all the kings of the earth shall praise you, O Lord, for they have heard the words you spoke. That we might have thought that if they heard, they also saw, therefore, scripture says, you yourself saw, meaning you saw, but the other nations of the world did not. That I spoke to you from the very heavens, one verse says, I spoke to you from the very heavens, while another says, the Lord came down, upon Mount Sinai. Do these verses not contradict one another? The difficulty is resolved by a third verse. From the heavens, he let you hear his voice to discipline you. On earth, he let you see his great fire, and from amidst the fire, you heard his voice. Thus far, the view of Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Akiva says, one verse says, I spoke to you from the very heavens, while another says, the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai on the top of the mountain. This teaches us that the Holy One, blessed be He, inclined the highest heavens down to the top of the mountain and spoke to them from that heaven that is written from the very heavens. Thus scripture said, he bent the sky and came down, thick cloud beneath his feet. But even thus he said, the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. One might have understood this literally, but it can be read as follows. If a servant to servants, the Son can be felt in one place and yet be in another, surely is even easier the glory of him who spoke and the world came to be.
Okay, so we have the first part in which everybody in the world heard about Har Sinai, but only Israel saw. Then we have the second part in which Rabbi Shmuel says that God remained in the heaven even though they saw it down on earth. While Rabbi Akiva says God bent heaven down to the people. What would you do with this as a modern in explaining Revelation? Yes?
Where Rabbi Akiva says, Rito Nasi said that God bent it. It seems from what he said, using the metaphor of the sun.
That's Rabbi Nasi, not Rabbi Akiva.
Right, Rabbi Nasi, that the metaphor of the sun, that he didn't bend it, that he was in heaven and it was felt down the earth, that he didn't come down.
Okay, so medieval will certainly say that there's a continuous power going forth. There's something forever coming down, which is there's a power of Nebuah within the world. Take the bottom line. The pyrotechnics will say for the Kabbalists. And the philosophers will only take you can access it like the sun. What will a 20th century person do with this? Yes?
Back then, wants to speak to them?
I don't know. What would you?
I'm saying the fact that he's speaking to them is the most important part. If not, everything else, the details of how they did it, would just be interpreted as, the location's so important, we have to bend the heavens.
Well, do you think most 20th century figures like this fact that God speaks to people? Are people in this class comfortable with that idea that God gets up there and, is bending down? Yes?
I think clearly they have to ask. There's some tension in this piece where they want to figure out the exact mechanics of how God's speaking. well, that would seem to be the irrelevant question. The very fact that God is speaking is the problem, not how he's achieving it. Or to say another way, if it's miraculous enough that God is speaking, why do you need to get into the mechanics of it? And if he's not speaking, then certainly the mechanics are irrelevant.
That's right. Modern 20th century figures do not really see, this, because the whole point is to account for God speaking. If God speaks, it doesn't really matter the mechanism, because the bigger thing is to account for it within our secular scientific world. And if you then allow that God spoke to people, then you don't have to go into this mechanism. Yes?
The speaking, many later 20th century thinkers would say that speaking is a simplistic metaphor. It's like you're just going to sit there and God's going to talk to you. How can that possibly account for the very great experience of revelation?
Who are you thinking of?
The beginning of the historical model.
I have no idea what you mean. Let's do one more of these. Some more data.
Where's this translation
from? This is all from Adnan's presence in Sinai.
Yeah. I understand why wouldn't mechanics be added so important?
Because if your whole point is proving that it can exist, that you're living in a secular world in which people walk down the street saying, well, I can understand halakha, but this Har Sinai and Revelation stuff I can't get into, to the whole big point is to prove Revelation and to get into the technical details of how the speaking occurred already seems like a side point. Let's do one more. Can I get someone to read at the bottom of the left? It's like Moses led the people toward God. Yes.
Moses led the people toward God. Rabbi Yosef said, according to you, God, the Lord came from Sinai, means he was revealed to Sinai. But I say it means he came down from Sinai to reach his children joyfully. This can be understood by a way of parable. What does the matter resemble? It resembles the case of a bridegroom who went out to greet his bride. The station of one who goes out to greet, one can infer a station of one to greet. That is why it says Moses led the people toward God. And they took their places beneath the mountain, huddled together. Concerning this, the tradition says, O my soul, for the crannies of the rocks hidden by the cliff. Rabbi Elazar says this verse refers to what happened at the sea. Let me see your face, Marat Pen, is as in the verse, stand by and witness. Ooh. The deliverance which the Lord will work for you today. Let me hear your voice, as in the verse, as Pharaoh drew near, the Israelites cried out to the Lord. For your voice is sweet, refers to the verse, their cry rose up to God. And your face is comely, refers to the verse, the people were convinced. When they heard that the Lord had taken note of the Israelites, they bowed low in homage. Rabbi Akiva said, the passage refers rather to what happened at Mount Sinai. Let me see your face refers to the verse, early in the morning, he set up an altar at the foot of the mountain. Let me hear your voice refers to the verses, all the people answered with one voice, saying, all that the Lord has spoken you will do, and you will hear. For your voice is sweet refers to the verse, the Lord said to me, I have heard the plea that this people made to you, and they did well to speak thus. And your face is comely at the tent of meeting, as it is written. They brought to the front of the tent of meeting the things that Moses had commanded. And the whole community came forward and stood before the Lord.
Okay, if you're not a capitalist dealing with the idea of bridegroom, bridal imagery, what would someone do with this text? Any thoughts on what someone would do with this text? Or the problems of this text?
I mean, if you're not interested in the imagery of bride and bridegroom, there's really nothing to do with it.
If they do that?
If you're not interested in that whole imagery of bride and bridegroom, then there's really, I mean, it's just very confusing. Like, what's going on here?
Okay.
Why is this an issue for us at all?
Okay. So with that as a little introduction, let's deal with, we're going to do, like I said, 20th century figures first, then we'll go back to the medievals, because it works better that way. Let's get out the 20th century issues to allow you to deal with the medievals in peace. So let's now turn to Dulles. Dulles is going to open up telling us that Revelation is a 18th and then 20th century issue. And that doing theology is not arguing about the possibility of something existing, but it's how you formulate it to make sense for yourself. He will create a distinction between the human element, and he's going to pick on Karl Jaspers here, the human element about us understanding our human world versus theology, in which we already have a given data, whether the Bible, the Talmud, or whatever our given data is. And then he gives us five models by which to deal with the material. You will know these five models inside out by the time we come to the midterm. Model number one, which he calls the doctrinal model, says revelation is possible because there was a doctrine given from God, and he then distinguishes that into two versions. The doctrinal model, in which God gives over statements, you know, very clean, here's the Bible, here's what God gave. And the other part of that would be what he calls the neo-scholastic doctrinal model, in which he treats the Bible as God's will and wisdom, as some of the great utterance, but not specifically the utterance we have now as being the same as the Bible. Meaning the first one says, Har Sinai, the whole Torah was given, here it is, and all Chidushim were given out, Moshe knew every ketzos in advance. Second position would say, no, there's a divine will and wisdom that was given over, and it's now found, let's say, within the halakhic process, or found within the world of Torah, but it's about emphasizing will and wisdom of the divine. Position number two is what Dulles called the historic position. Revelation was not about a doctrine or teaching. Revelation was about an event. And in the Jewish case, the creation of Am Yisrael. And the most that I've learned from teaching this course is that one gets the most actual headcount of actual Jewish figures. That what Harsin, I mean, I expected when I first opened up everything, you know, and if you looked at on the handouts, which also includes of Irving Bunnan and of Victor Miller and everyone else, I expected to find doctrinal statements. Instead, I found almost everyone had the historic statements. Revelation and Torah Sinai was an event that created Am Yisrael rather than a doctrine. It was an event that changed the people, that created the people, that made us special people. And what counts in Har Sinai was the creation of a people, not a specific doctrine. Very surprised, and that one is actually more people hold that than any others. Position number three is the experiential position. Har Sinai represents an experience of God. And the most famous traditionalist to hold that position in the 20th century is Heschel, that there's a direct experience of God. But we will see others. Rav Kook will hold that position, that Har Sinai was an experience of God. Not a doctrine, not a people, but an experience. Position number four is the dialectic position. And this one will take a little bit of explaining when we get there. That's the position of Rav Soloveitchik and Yeshaya Leibowitz and Michael Wishengrad and others, in which we live unredeemed secular existences and revelation was our now having a redemptive act, a redemptive confrontation or encounter with the divine that transforms us into religious human beings. So unlike number three, that actually talks about the ancient experience and the current experience, position number four talks about the acceptance of Har Sinai as something that then moves us from our natural condition into being religious figures, into now taking upon ourselves a new element outside of culture. And that's why it's called dialectic, because it remains dialectic with culture. It's outside of your normal human experience. I mean, the secular realm remains secular, but you can now take on, you're now, as the essay is called, confrontation. We have a dual confrontation for the Rav, our confrontation of Tzelem Elohim with all other human beings, and our confrontation, the specific one, of Har Sinai, and it's about confrontations. Position number three, there was a direct experience. Position number two, you created a people. And position number one, the most important thing, was the doctrine revealed. Position number five, the human consciousness, that's the one that assumes that revelation is some quality that we have within us. So that's the most, what we, in some ways, call the most liberal of the five. Revelation is part of the human process of either seeking out the divine or potential within us to come to the divine. Yes, your question.
What was the Christian thinkers? Which, because you said that the Jewish are primarily into
two.
Sorry, yeah.
I mean, Dulles is going to point that out. How Christian, very few Christians hold in position number two. Most evangelicals are position number one. Most Christians are going to be position three and five. Yes.
I know you're talking about this elsewhere, but about this, they don't like bringing the whole Wissenschaftsschule into the discussion.
Meaning
that the people who you're discussing from the modern, the most recent era, the more the traditionalist school. So where would you place, the Wissenschaftsschule?
I don't know who's in the Wissenschaftsschule.
Anybody from 19th century historical school Judaism in Germany, in America. Was it historic or is it?
The answer is they didn't really speak about the issue. That was the whole point. They avoided theology. They tended to be they were more concerned with the correct editing of texts than dealing with the theological question. We will deal with, for example, when we deal with Hirsch, we'll deal with the Reformed thinker Steinem. This is not being divided Orthodox, non-Orthodox, or anything like that. But somebody who completely avoids the question is not dealt with, and that's why this course is very different. Because if I told you what do you people believe about Revelation, most of the people you tend to put on the list tend to be people who don't really have an opinion or shouldn't have an opinion, because basically they spend their lives editing manuscripts. Anybody who has a real opinion and something to say will be on the list. So therefore, Buber will be on the list as someone to deal with. But I'm not sure who you're thinking of, in this category, Wissenschaft.
Or Leopold Zins.
What?
Leopold Zins.
He doesn't have, that's the whole point. That's exactly the whole point. Yes?
Has the human consciousness model explained the actual monotheism? Was it like a collective reaching of the end?
That's what we're going to get there. It's going to be some form of that, and we're going to talk about it. We'll give examples. The most famous two examples of that, who we're going to use, is going to be Emmanuel Levinas, and we're going to then use Josefa Orr as an interesting Maimonidean version of that. I mean, his version is that anybody who, is understanding that at that point they reach this human capacity at that moment. And that's what we're going to work through.
And that's what was number five?
Yeah. However surprising that is.
Okay.
Dulles, you'll read through Dulles. Dulles will point out, we do have to answer, as he formulates it, how does the church itself know about Revelation? Or if we put it in Jewish terms, how do Jews know about Revelation? Do we know about it through the Bible? Well, are we now going to limit ourselves to Perek Yutet and Da'in Shmot and then Dalet in Devarim and then Kapitel Samachet in Tehillim? Are we going to understand Revelation through the Chazals we just did? If so, most of you would come out quite like, I don't know what to do with these Chazals. How do you yourself know about its very existence? But once again, think about that question. If you hold experience, well, your own experience plays a role. If you hold history, it's part of the collective Mesorah or being part of Am Yisrael. If you hold number four, it's your own human confrontation with the divine. Where does the data come from? Dulles points out the importance of philosophy, not as answering our questions, but as making sure we don't make mistakes. Philosophy is useful for formulating our answers. Yes?
Yeah, some of these models, I mean, some of them just don't negate each other. It's just an issue of emphasis. Would that be...
Keep going.
Or are you saying that these are all, like, if you believe, if you take one, you can't take the other? Because I can definitely see how someone how a philosopher can emphasize the historic part, yet still believe that it's doctrinal and also experiential.
Okay. So the answer is, from the 20th century point of view, for most they were mutually exclusive. From the 21st century point of view, where we are now, it doesn't seem that way. And if you look at sections 6, 7, and 8, if you look at the syllabus, we're then going to talk about how to combine them. Can you hold 1, 3, and 5? Can you hold 2 and 4? Can you... And who does and who doesn't? But in the 20th century, because we had a very sharp question, science told you there was a problem. How do you answer it? And why did science tell you a problem? Here are 8 things that science said that made revelation impossible in the 20th century. First, 20th century was a period of philosophic agnosticism. Whether you're going to attribute it to Hume, Kant, Freud, Marx, doesn't really matter. It was philosophic agnostic century. Two.
What does that mean?
It means that the God was not a part of any equation. You could not ever affirm God as part of any cultural statement in the 20th century. Even if you were a believer, you talked about the difficulties of belief and the tensions and how do I overcome the agnosticism, which means revelation becomes a problem, because if I need a clean statement about revelation, all your, you know, grappling in the dark of 20th century agnosticism, you know, whether you're reading Hume saying ism is the author, there is no passage, I can't empirically ever get anywhere, or you're coming from Waiting for Godot, or whatever you're coming from, 20th century was an agnostic century. Two, linguistic analysis. For much of the 20th century, something could only be true if it could be falsified. Most philosophers in the 20th century believed in the falsification principle. If I couldn't prove it false, then I couldn't prove it true. Three.
Why linguistic analysis?
Because that's what you generally call it, to be able to say linguistic analysis coming from air and onward. Three, modern epistemology starts with the self, and there's no way to get from the self to the divine. That's going to be a big one for some of those who would choose the dialectic approach. How do I overcome the self? You know, they're not worried about questions about the perfume and the resurrection of the dead in our scene. How do I overcome the limits of the self? Four, how do I overcome it psychologically? Can I just put someone, in the old days of DSM 2 and 3, would have listed you as a schizophrenic if you had a relationship with the divine. DSM 4 is not so harsh on religion. But for most of this century, psychology, you could have clearly gotten yourself a schizophrenic label by claiming any religious experience.
William James were all about mystical experiences. He was like a leading one.
That's correct. That is correct. And therefore, there are those who would have said he would be, he would have had a disassociative experience. And you've got to deal with that problem. If I tell you, oh, at Har Sinai, they smell the divine that you resurrected, you can walk around the 20th century. That's not going to get you far. Five, biblical criticism. And biblical criticism having two parts. Not what people generally think as some general issue, but biblical criticism was a problem because biblical criticism assumed that the Bible was a human document like all other human documents. And two, biblical criticism assumes that miracles are impossible. So it's not the question of authorship, it's the real question of either, it's the basic premise of being a human document. Six, the problem of historicism. And this is what most people call the biblical criticism problem. History will tell us that the Bible is an ancient text. Every age is different. How can you listen to ancient texts? We live in a post-Copernicus world. Two more points and then I'm going to let you go. Number seven, comparative religion. How can I treat these chazals literally if I have all these nice Hindu and Buddhist texts that say similar things? How can you say this one is unique or a revelation? And finally, the sociological question, how can I submit to divine authority if I now believe in modern autonomy and modern freedom? And the answer, whatever theologians come up to answer these questions, they have to answer all of these eight questions as 20th century thinkers. We will continue with this next class. Please get a hold of Dulles. I will finish introductions, and then we're going to start some Summer Paul Hirsch, and the 19th century, we'll do some reform thinkers with that also.